This is Peace Talks Radio, the radio series and podcast on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, today with Megan Kamrick. Each year, about 1 million people in the United States attempt to take their own lives. Another 10 million people seriously consider suicide. Those rates tend to rise in troubling years, like during the coronavirus pandemic of 2020 and 2021. These statistics became very real for us at Peace Talks Radio when a talented young producer named Hannah Colton, who did several episodes for us, took her own life in November 2020. On this episode, we talk with psychologist Dr. Ursula Whiteside about her efforts to stop suicide. And later we also talk about the difficulty journalists face as frontline responders with Bruce Shapiro, executive director of the DART Center for Journalism and Trauma. And we'll finish our program with some highlights of Hannah's work on Peace Talks Radio. And we'll be talking frankly about suicide and trauma on this episode. If you are in crisis and need to talk to someone, you can text 741-741 to reach a counselor at the Crisis Text Line. You can also call the Suicide Hotline at 800-273-8255. Those numbers again, the text number is 741-741, or the Suicide Hotline, 800-273-8255. Hannah Colton was only 29 and was serving as interim news director at KUNM in Albuquerque when she died. Here's one of her colleagues from KUNM, Megan Kamrick, who also produces for Peace Talks Radio and produced today's episode.
Hannah stepped in to lead our newsroom in a year that became one of the most traumatic and intense any of us have ever experienced. 2020 gave us a global pandemic, a resulting economic calamity, and then mass protests for racial justice. Of course, it also turned out to be one of the most divisive election years in history. Hannah was passionate about elevating voices from communities that often go unheard in our media. And she was fearless about pursuing stories, working hundreds of hours to cover protests, and also guiding us in our coverage. She was passionate about equity and racial justice, and she was incredibly gifted at talking with all kinds of people and bringing forth their stories. Hannah was also managing depression, and that proved more challenging during the pandemic, as it has for millions of people. The reasons behind suicide are complex and often unknowable, but we wanted to talk about possible solutions with Dr. Ursula Whiteside. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and CEO of NowMattersNow.org. It's a site dedicated to providing tools for people struggling with suicidal thoughts. She has herself struggled with anxiety and depression and works to ensure that the voices of those with lived experience are included in these conversations. Dr. Ursula Whiteside, many of us who are left behind after a friend or family member goes through with suicide are plagued by guilt and a lot of questions. What are warning signs that someone may be considering suicide?
Well, I want to say to you, and I want to say to other people who've lost someone to suicide, that sometimes there's nothing obvious going on, and it's almost impossible to see. You know, you can't be inside someone's head, and that guilt and wishing you could know then what you know now doesn't tend to serve us well. You know, that's on people like myself and the public health system and the medical system to better train family members, friends, people who are struggling to support each other, to reach out. The vast majority of signs of suicide also just mean that the person's in a really bad spot, unhappy, probably experiencing some depression, anxiety. But extended periods of difficulty sleeping is something to watch out for. Extended periods of withdrawal and also irritability or pushing people away. Definitely talking about suicide is something that would be something very important to follow up on, to ask that person what they mean, to have them explain what's going on with them in their life, you know, with real curiosity before trying to convince them of anything, you know, whether or not to do that. Those are some of the, you know, the most important ones. And there's a great list on American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.org, AFSP.org, where you can find more information.
We will put that on our website along with other resources for sure. So this idea that sometimes when people turn to suicide, there's been a surge of emotions. It's very sudden.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that.
as part of a research project, we interviewed a whole group of people about their suicide attempts. In general, their lives were not going well. And on the day that they attempted, which for those folks that I interviewed, they had not had a specific plan to harm themselves, there was usually something that happened, like a fight or something that seemed like the end of a relationship or something that seemed like it was going to be impossible moving forward, or at least it felt that way in the moment. And the combination of like emotions being fairly high with this additional thing that had some kind of really important meaning to the person sort of pushed them over the edge, and they made an attempt when they hadn't planned, when they hadn't had much forethought into it, and it really wasn't anticipated. I think there's something really important about knowing that this is a thing that allows us to do something differently, because we haven't really been thinking that much about this suicidal experience. We think a lot about the person who writes the letter, who finishes up their will, who like takes steps in advance, but we don't think as much about what would you do to intervene and support somebody who may be at risk of having this overwhelming urge happen. It's never just one thing that causes someone to take their life or to attempt to take their life. But then sometimes it can be this combination of a whole bunch of different factors, and then one especially intense thing may put them at greater risk. People need to be prepared for this experience. At some point, for all of us, we're going to have these really intense moments, and many of us will say, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, where my stress level was 100 out of 100, and I just didn't even know what to do. We need to prepare everybody for what to do, whether or not suicidal thoughts come into our minds, because at the basis of it, it's just really, really intense emotion. And how do you handle really, really intense emotion? Because it affects most of us in a very similar way.
Dr. Whiteside, what steps can people take if they are find themselves overwhelmed suddenly by these intense feelings that you describe?
One of the things that we know works really well to help reset intense emotions is to use cold. The research that's been done is all about people filling a bowl or the sink with very cold water, even putting some ice in there, and bending at the waist while holding your breath, trying to do that for 30 seconds while your face is submerged under the water, and then coming back up and taking a deep breath. And doing that on repeat 3 to 5 minutes changes the way that your vagus nerve or vagal nerve responds. So there's this nerve that runs between your brain and your major organs. It innervates your organs. If you can get that nerve to change its tone, change the way its tautness, you can essentially change the messaging between your organs and your brain and trick your brain into thinking that you're becoming more relaxed.
That is fascinating.
I agree. And I use it all the time when I need to. I happen to be one of those people who has intense emotions. And it doesn't necessarily mean I'm having suicidal thoughts if I'm using cold. It just means like I'm so overwhelmed that I can't think clearly anymore. And it's not helping anybody at this point.
Are there other things people can do if they're in that crisis moment?
When you're in a really emotional state, we should hold off making important decisions. We're not seeing clearly enough to make decisions, and this is a time when people make those decisions that they can't take back. And I got a lot of great feedback from a group of young people that I interviewed about them getting through these, we call hot moments, being on fire emotionally. And they said it wasn't so helpful when people said, you're not always going to feel this way. What was more helpful, they said, was when someone would say, hey, we're just going to work on getting through the next 30 minutes.
What does that look like?
It does take creativity. So what I might scan through my head is like, what does this person like? What calms this person down? For some people, it's, you know, having them sit on the couch, sit really close to them, you know, put your arms around them. I try to get people to drink a big cold glass of water as another way to help change their physiology, or put an ice pack behind their head. I'll practice breathing and say, I'm going to start breathing. I want you to breathe with me. And then as I'm doing that, I'll make my exhale a little longer than my inhale, because that's it's a type of breathing that can help slow somebody down a little bit faster than just deep breathing. I definitely weave in humor. I might pull up a picture of, you know, the cat on the phone. And I also will say, like, just, you know, I'm not going to do this perfectly, so just bear with me. I'm just do my best to be with you, because I love you. And just hang in here with me.
And Dr. Ursula Whiteside, you helped create an organization called Now Matters Now, and you're the CEO. What is the site? What is the mission behind it?
This resource is intended to bring videos of people talking about how they use coping strategies called dialectical behavior therapy skills. There's also resources for healthcare providers to receive training. And there's training on the website for family members and friends or people who are struggling in something called micro-interventions. So things that help you, that you can do in 3 to 5 minutes that can help with mood and getting through hard times. There's a safety plan. There's a crisis lines page and crisis steps, like some of the crisis steps I told you about with cold and no important decisions. There's another step called eye contact, which is explained on the website.
Why is eye contact important?
Eye contact, because it is one of the strongest stimuli. When people are in an intense suicidal mindset, like, they are super focused on suicide. It's almost like the rest of the room is gray or black, and suicide is in bright red letters in front of them, and that's all they can see. And what you're trying to do is put something else in front of their eyes, right? Like something else to wash out some of that red in their brain. And eye contact is one of the most powerful stimuli that we know. It's so powerful. And so what that would mean is if you were really struggling, you would say to someone like, hey, I just can't get out of my head right now. You know, could we talk for a little bit? Could you look at me for a little while?
Many people who attempt suicide may also be trying to manage depression or other mental health challenges. How can these accelerate or lead to suicide?
One of the especially cruel things about depression is that the urges that go along with it are to withdraw and to stop reaching out and to stop making real connection. One of the simple things that you can do if you're depressed and you're starting to withdraw is to force yourself to do small things. So an example would be to send a text to somebody who, you know, you're fairly certain won't judge you, that you trust, maybe even somebody who's been depressed themselves and is open about it. And at the minimum, say, I'm thinking about you, and send a picture of you guys together, or, you know, something that makes that text, bumps it up a little bit in connection. Even more effective would be to say, like, hey, this morning really sucks. I'm having trouble getting out of bed. I'm committing to jumping in the shower, and I'll text you after I've taken a shower. Those are a couple ways that you can fight back with depression and depression urges, and fight against the isolation that it tends to create.
It can be really frightening if someone confides in us that they're in crisis. What can we do if we suspect our friend or loved one is considering suicide?
I know we tend to get really anxious when someone's talking to us about it, but I think we should also be holding on to the fact that, like, this is a really good thing. My job right now is to be present with them and see if I can understand a little bit better, see if there's something I can do to help them get through this.
This kind of goes to a potential way to address some of this that you have explored, caring messages.
Yeah. Caring context. This was an intervention that was done many, many, many years ago, 30, 40 years ago, with people who were just leaving a psychiatric hospital after a suicide-related visit. Half of them got follow-up over mail. They got a letter in the mail. These letters were done over time, not just once. And they essentially just expressed care, that the letter writer was holding space for that person and that person mattered. The way I use, and many others use this now, is with text messaging. In the original study, the people who received these caring messages, you know, there were half as many suicides as there were in those that didn't get the caring messages. So,
wow. How can we use that technique in our own lives?
I think one thing that you can do is take, 60 seconds and think about who in your life has sort of like faded out a little bit. Who haven't you heard from that you used to hear from, or who hasn't been on social media that used to be on, who lost a job, who's going through a divorce. Men especially, they're more likely to die by suicide and often in some ways have less connections. Who would those three people be? And then start sending them regular messages like, hey, the game's on Saturday. I'm going to be watching it. You want to watch it virtually with me? I know this is out of the blue, but I miss you. I'm thinking of you.
There's much more with Dr. Ursula Whiteside at our website, peacetalksradio.com, as well as links to resources and her site, nowmattersnow.org. Look for our January 2021 episode at our website, peacetalksradio.com. And remember, if you are in crisis and need someone to talk to, you can text 741-741 to reach a counselor at the crisis text line. You can also call the suicide hotline at 800-273-8255. 800-273-8255. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls today along with Megan Kamrick, and our show's been about confronting suicide and understanding the pressure on news reporters in difficult times. The show is dedicated to our colleague and occasional Peace Talks radio host, Hannah Colton, who took her own life in November of 2020. She was just 29. When we think first responders, we probably think of firefighters or police, but journalists also tend to run toward danger, especially in 2020 and 2021 in the coronavirus pandemic, and that also makes them vulnerable to trauma. The DART Center for Journalism and Trauma was created to give journalists better tools to cover violence and tragedy, but its mission has expanded to help journalists deal with their own trauma around covering these events so they can continue doing their jobs, which are vital to a functioning democracy. Bruce Shapiro is the executive director of the DART Center, and he spoke with Megan Kamrick.
Around the world, journalists everywhere cover a huge amount of human distress. And it's not just frontline war correspondents and not just cops reporters. When there is a big police shooting, when there are events like the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, when there are violent protests like that, these are all hands-on-deck moments. And also, as young reporters, many of us, including me, my first assignments involved loss, involved murder victims, involved veterans coming back from war. We cover a lot, and all the research shows that journalists all over the world cover a lot of suffering, number one. Number two, we know, and this is actually good news, we now know from the research that on the whole, we as journalists are a pretty resilient tribe. Having a job to do in the face of mayhem and suffering, having craft skills, having ethical skills, having good colleagues, and having a clear mission, these are all protective factors and act as a buffer against the degree sometimes of psychological injury that you might expect. The challenge is that if we cover events which by themselves are significantly more horrifying or overwhelming or involve things like the deaths of children or are chronically threatening or resonate with other kind of biographical traumatic experiences we may have, the mechanisms of post-traumatic stress disorder are the very mechanisms that we rely on most as news professionals. So it can become singularly toxic. We rely on the accuracy and controllability of memory. Well, folks with PTSD often deal with intrusive memory, overwhelming floods of memory that are triggered and take up attention when it's not wanted. Or people with psychological injury may have anxious arousal, may be unable to concentrate, focus, to be there in the moment in the way that we as reporters need. Or folks may lose their ability to make empathetic connection, and we rely on that in a profound way. And that's consequential. When journalists lose their ability to function well because of post-traumatic stress disorder or because of burnout or other work-related occupational stress injuries. That's a kind of censorship. A journalist who's no longer able to meet a deadline or get on with sources or put together a story is censored as effectively as if imprisoned.
How have all these things been exacerbated by the dangers journalists have faced in recent years from open hostility to the media?
You know, it's so interesting. 10 years ago, in our work at the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma, when we were thinking about physical threats to journalists, those mostly involved the risks to frontline correspondents in war zones or in crisis areas, or perhaps investigative reporters who were specifically targeted by mobsters or oligarchs. That's completely changed. When I go into newsrooms now, there are local, completely apolitical police reporters and crime reporters who are subjected to torrents of abuse in the comment sections of news sites or digital threat and harassment. In journalism schools now, we need to teach our young reporters how to safeguard their digital identities and to safeguard their own families from threat and abuse. It's become a legitimate part, unfortunately, of our political culture to attack journalists. And this is adding levels of threat and stress to a profession that already is, A, deals with all the trauma exposure I was just talking about, and B, is beleaguered by cuts to newsroom budgets, turmoil and disruption in the industry. The sense of being a profession under siege is emotionally really pretty challenging for a lot of journalists. We get into this, most of us, because of a public service mission. And if that mission is constantly being invalidated or is threatened and we're not being defended, that can leave us feeling more alone and isolated and can exacerbate or can become an added burden of threat. And I think the burden is all the more significant because in the kind of broader democratic crisis of American society right now, it's really striking how journalism is actually sort of the pathway out. I mean, a lot of people said, well, is there light at the end of the tunnel? And my view has become that actually reporting is the light to the end of the tunnel. At a time when official science has been corrupted by political interest, it's left to journalism to be the capillary system for public health understanding. At a time when government communication has been corrupted by politics, it's left to journalists not only to ask the right questions, but to model a kind of engagement with these issues. The role of journalism in American society has never been more important than it is now as mediators of fact, as mediators of the social contract. And the reporters I talk to, though they don't use that kind of very elaborate, maybe even theoretical framework, are very aware of the importance of their work right now. And on the one hand, this is a source of a lot of stress, a lot of worry. It's also a source of mission and a lot of resilience. And to the extent that folks in journalism can articulate that mission and share it with one another, and to the extent to which the public understands that and can express appreciation for the work of news professionals right now, I think it's a source of resilience. And if the public believes ultimately in the need of accurate information and the need for powerful storytelling and the need for journalists to speak truth to power and to bear witness for those who are at the losing end of the power equation, then the public too needs to understand just how consequential are the risks that news professionals take, even at the community level, to fulfill their responsibilities in our still democratic society.
You can find more with Bruce Shapiro of the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at our website, peacetalksradio.com. You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. In November of 2016, I was at a radio conference in Chicago. A young reporter named Hannah Colton asked to meet with me. Hannah wanted to ask me how to make it as a freelance reporter, how to file stories, what shows were taking stories from freelancers, that kind of thing. Partway through our meeting, she mentioned that she was just about to move to New Mexico, where I lived. She arrived in New Mexico not long after that, and once I heard Hannah's work just a few times on the air, I approached her about producing and hosting some episodes of our Peace Talks radio series. She agreed, and lucky for us, she produced a couple of excellent episodes in 2018 before moving on to work full-time with KUNM News. And as we said, Hannah committed suicide in November 2020, 9 months after becoming the station's interim news director. The first of her two Peace Talks radio programs explored peacemaking messages and hip-hop music. Among Hannah's passions were music and peace and justice. Here's a clip from her interview in that episode with rapper Brother Ali.
You know, people, a lot of white people who haven't explored hip-hop might think of it as, you know, glorifying misogyny, sex, money, fame. I mean, it's easy for a lot of people to fall back on those stereotypes. But you talk about the genius of hip-hop and really honoring the Black culture that it comes from. I mean, why do you think that that in particular is important to spread and for people to understand?
You know, you still have artists that do really amazing work that are making really incredible hip-hop music that are about, you know, beauty and dignity and joy and love, and they're humorous, and all of the parts of a complex human being are still coming through this music. It would be easy to make a two-hour playlist of songs that are about, you know, peace and peacemaking. You know, the tradition is just really rich with that.
Maybe we'll ask you to do that sometime, make that playlist.
That'd be cool.
You said that the ladies couldn't make it, you must be blind. If you don't believe what here, listen to this rhyme. Ladies first, there's no time to rehearse. I'm divine and my mind expands throughout the universe. A female rapper.
Hannah Colton talking with Brother Ali, and you can hear that whole peacemaking and hip-hop program at peacetalksradio.com. It was our June 2018 episode. That was released just 2 years before Hannah took her own life at the age of 29 in November of 2020. And again, this program today has been dedicated to Hannah. We looked at suicide prevention and explored the very real pressures on journalists to cover difficult news. To hear this program again or share it with others, look for the January 2021 episode of our series at peacetalksradio.com. Now to close, here again is our correspondent and colleague of Hannah's in the KUNM News Department, Megan Kamrick.
Hannah left a short note before she died, and one of the things she wrote was that people should not report on the means she used to take her life. I asked her mother if I could share this fact because it speaks volumes about her and about our profession. Hannah understood the harm media can cause, and she knew the ethical guidelines journalists are supposed to follow in reporting on suicide, and one of those is to not go into detail about methods. The National Alliance on Mental Illness notes that numerous studies have found that certain types of news coverage can increase the likelihood of suicide in vulnerable individuals, and detailing methods is one of the worst things media can do. This last missive from Hannah is especially profound for me. Even in the worst moment of her life, she was committed to the ideals of good, ethical journalism. We will strive to continue her work.